The morning session closed by pointing out that James Hutton in the 18th century, Charles Lyell in the 19th century, were responsible for a theory that says that the forces that are now operating in this physical earth have always operated in the same manner and with the same result as they have through the ages. Now, you'll notice what we read in Hebrews 11 and 3? The things which are? What things? The mountains, the oceans, the lakes, the rivers, the valleys. The things which are were not made of things which do appear. What does that mean? It means that the uniformity theory of geology is totally opposite to what the Bible says. And it is a theory built on a crumbling foundation. It's a fairy tale for adults. I'm sorry to insult anyone who believes in it, but it truly is. It's an alternative for God. Don't ever forget that, and I'm going to try to prove that to you in this session. Prove it to you from the very statements of the men who are the authors, both of the uniformity theory and of the evolutionary theory. So, what do we actually have? We mentioned that Charles Darwin found that there was a progression of species. Now, by a progression of species, I mean that we look around us in our world and we see life from the very simplest form to the most complex. And no difficulty in us believing that man, even the physical man, even our physical bodies, are the end product of a long line of progression from the simplest life form to the most complex. Evolution says that the most complex came out of the most simple form. Darwin taught that species evolved from other species from the simplest to the most complex. That's evolution. By evolved means that they grew upward, they developed upward, they evolved upward is the best way to say it. And the only thing he had to prove that was that there is a progression from the simplest life form to the most complex. I was reading one day in Psalm 139. I could hardly believe that I'd missed it for so many years. The man who wrote Psalm 139 is speaking about how he was formed. Some of you will know this very well, I'm sure. He says, "My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there were none of them." What does that mean anyway? It means that God had in mind, when he created the simplest forms of life, God had the ultimate creation in mind, man. And it means that he made all those lower forms of creation that he was working toward a goal. And that goal was the creation of Adam. So progression is absolutely a fact. The scripture actually teaches that God saw the result. God saw the end product, man, when he was making a protozoan. So there is the progression. However, is there any evidence that one species came out of another? No. There is no evidence of it in nature. There isn't a shred of evidence of it in the fossil record. I don't know just how much we'll get into fossils in this particular session, but let me just say one or two words about fossils to kind of help you. All of you know what a fossil is. It's actually, it is a what is left when a bone, when a fern, when a plant, when a tree, an animal of any kind has died, decayed, and in the shape of the bones or the form of a fern, if it happens to be a plant, minerals actually filled up as the various fibers of the original substance decayed, minerals filled up from water, that particular shape, until what we have left is really stone. Fossils are stones. They are minerals. And it is what is left of the original shape after it has decayed. In other words, a fossil bone is not a bone. A fossil bone is in the shape that the bone originally was. But actually it is made up of minerals, and it will not decay, of course, any more than any rock will decay. So there is a fossil record, isn't there? In the rock layers that are called strata, there is a record of life. It goes back in that rock record to what men call the Precambrian era. And in the Precambrian era, they tell us there were the very simplest life forms. We're going to look at that a little more carefully if we get time. I don't know if we will. However, while I'm speaking now about fossils, you see, paleontologists believe that they can date the rock strata, the rock layers, they can date them from the fossils that are found in them. You with me? They find a certain fossil in a particular kind of rock, and they say, we know how old this rock is, because we know how long it took for evolution to happen. You know what I think of when I read that sort of thing? I think of the little boy who told his mother he was 10 feet tall. The mother said, you're not 10 feet tall. He said, I am. She said, why are you saying that? Well, he said, I measured myself. Well, she said, what did you use to measure yourself? He said, a ruler. She said, and where did you get the ruler? He said, I made it. So he was 10 feet tall. That's exactly what has happened with evolution. It's exactly what has happened in the fossil record. They find a particular fossil in a certain kind of rock, and they say, okay, this rock is so many millions of years old. I might even tell you it's billions. Up to maybe 4.6 billion or something of that kind for our Earth. And they say, this fossil in this rock tells us how old this rock is. How do they know how old the fossils are? By that kind of a ruler the little boy made, because actually they tell the age of the fossils by the rock in which they're found. If you boys and girls were to answer questions like that on an examination paper, you get failed. That's called circle reasoning. No good. It's not logical. You can't age index fossils by rock and then date the rock by the fossils that are found in them. I know that many, many geologists, paleontologists, and so forth have written great long articles to, you know, say they don't believe that. Nevertheless, that is how the theory all began. And of course, the theory is not discredited by these men. They still contend that this is all the case. So Darwin actually said that one species evolved from another. This is also what Darwin said. I'm quoting him. This is his own words. Darwin said, not one change of a species into another is on record. What kind of record is he talking about? The fossil record. There is not in the fossil record one single case where they have transitioned from one species to another. There are no transitional fossils available. Should there be? If the species, the different kinds of animals, plants, man, if they evolved from one species to another, there would be how many? I don't know. There would be millions of transitional fossils. And there are none. You know, I quoted this morning, I read the words of Darwin this morning, "He who rejects these views because of the geological record will rightly," hear that? Darwin said, "will rightly reject my theory." Darwin was not so sure. I know that from having read a great deal of what he wrote. He was not sure. But of course, men came behind him. It's something like happens sometimes in religion. John Calvin taught total sovereignty. And really, I've read everything John Calvin wrote, and I would say that I couldn't find much fault with what he wrote. But those who came after him, they used his teachings to obliterate any thought of human responsibility at all. So that's what happens. So men who took up Darwin's theory, they pushed it to the... What is that expression they mean by today when they say they pushed the envelope? Well, they pushed the envelope to the extreme. And so, actually, I read you this morning the words of George Wald in referring to the creation of life, the origin of life, and this involves this whole story. He said, "Spontaneous generation is impossible, but we are here, therefore I believe it." If believing something impossible is possible, then I'm afraid words have lost their meaning. So, dear Christian, you're not in some retroactive group of people who don't know anything, because we believe the Word of God. Dear Mr. Moody was asked if he defended the Bible. And Mr. Moody answered, "Do you ever hear of defending a lion?" He said, "Open the cage door and it will look after itself." That's what we feel like in meetings. Let the Word of God speak. So now you see, it distinctly tells us in Hebrews 11 and 3 that the things which are were not made by the things which do appear. So this has not all evolved. It has been created by God Himself. Amazing, isn't it, that 2 Peter 3 gives us a description of uniformity in actual language. It says, "These people say that since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation." Get the word creation. They're talking about the physical creation. All things continue as they were. These processes that are going on, these particular things that are happening all around us have always happened like this, and to the same degree and in the same manner and with the same force. You remember the illustration about the swimming pool? We're going to come back to that. That a trickle of water will take a tremendous long time to fill it. A flood would fill it in seconds. So the time in which these things happen all depends on the amount of force. There's an equation here. I'm not much of a mathematician, and I'm going to try to give you some mathematics this afternoon, but I can't really claim to be much of a mathematician, but there's an equation in this. That force plus matter equals result. The degree of the force, the degree of the matter, will determine the result. And we're going to come back to that, because we believe that there is powerful evidence that the Genesis flood, a worldwide flood, actually produced what we have in the topography of Earth. It produced mollusks on the top of mountains. It actually raised mountain ranges. There was an elevation of continents. There was actually a depression, a sinking down of continents. And we believe that the force of the flood was so cataclysmic that the whole earth's shape and form were changed by the flood. And all of you perhaps know the name Dr. Henry Morris. His original book was called the Genesis Flood. He collaborated with Dr. Whitcomb in the production of the Genesis Flood, and Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. Whitcomb have written many, many books since, and perhaps you've read them all. I hope you have, because they won't do you a bit of harm, because they are men who believe the Bible and believe it is God's Word, and we don't need to make any excuses for it. We don't need to defend it. It will defend us. Now, what did Darwin actually see? He saw this progression of forms from the simplest to the most complex. So within the species, he never saw any transition from one species to another, not in the fossil record or in nature. So what did he see? Well, he saw adaptation within species. Adaptation, I don't think that's a word that we would make a mistake on. In other words, butterflies adapt to their environment. There is an outstanding case of that, and evolutionists use this as one of their arguments, that in industrial Britain, there was what was known, and still is, a peppered moth, and that peppered moth had a very light color. But when the Industrial Revolution came to Great Britain, and there were all kinds of factories belching out pollution, black soot and everything else that goes with combustion, the almost white pepper moths became black. Almost black, they became much darker. And evolutionists point to that and say, there's the evidence of evolution. You see, there it is. It changed from light to dark to so they would be more successfully hidden from their enemies. If a white moth lands on a dark surface, it's too obvious. So here they adapted their color for their own protection. Do I believe that? I sure do. Think of the canine species. Did God make German shepherds and Labrador retrievers and French poodles? No, God made the canine species. What we have within that species is adaptation. And lots of times it isn't just adaptation, as some of you know well. It is human efforts at breeding. And so men have interfered and have actually joined together certain characteristics they wanted to find. You know, that's the story of the quarter horses. That's the story of the thoroughbreds. You know what has happened? And they have adapted themselves with particular characteristics which are more desirable. Does that happen? It happens everywhere. It happens all around us. Happening all the time. All right now, that does happen. That's adaptation. Darwin believed that seeing that is visible, that then one species evolves into another. I told you I was going to go back to that session in the University of Manitoba. By the time this happened, there were not 12 professors present, but there were 30. Some of them were tutors. They weren't all professors, but all the professors of the School of Natural Science were there. And by this time, we were talking about evolution. And the dear man sat right beside me. He's a geneticist. He actually is a Hindu by religion. And he sat beside me, and he said to me, "I see evolution every day in the lab." He said, "You're saying that we don't observe evolution." He said, "I see it every day." You know, when somebody says something like that, don't jump in. I've done that to my own hurt. So I said to him, "How? Tell me." Now, he was different than most of those other men. Most of those other men were real gentlemen. But I think he wanted to put me under the table. He wouldn't have had much trouble doing that, you know, because he would know millions of things that I know nothing about. But he started to talk about Drosophila. My heart went up to God with a simple thanksgiving because I know about Drosophila. He could have landed on almost any species and I would have been sunk. But in the goodness of God, He talked about using radiation as a transmutating element to mutate the genes. What are Drosophila, you say? Well, you know them as fruit flies. So he told about using radiation in the lab to mutate the genes of the Drosophila. And he explained it in great detail. Obviously, he was very much involved in his work. And when he was finished, I said, what was the result? I didn't know what the result was, although I kind of did. But all those other men, they all started to laugh. And I just let them laugh. I looked around at them, and they were all laughing. And the man himself, he wouldn't say any more. And so a man across the table said, he was able to cause a mutation in the genes of Drosophila so that they were hatched without any wings. I said, oh, great success. Natural selection. Evolution. And then they weren't finished with them yet. Another man down the table said, and they were sterile. Yeah. So he didn't mutate anything. Now that's pretty well the story of natural selection. I don't know how I can tell it to you better than that. That's pretty well the story. Every mutation, except maybe about 1% of all mutations that men have ever attempted by electrical impulse, by radiation, by chemical reaction, almost every effort they have made at mutation has only caused destruction. It has only caused damage. So they've destroyed the ability of whatever they were working on to even duplicate itself, to be able to have offspring. What did Genesis say? Everything after its kind. Plants, animals, the whole creation. God gave that ability. He put that blueprint in. That's why when men cross even closely related species, they don't get a new species. They get a sterile result. The offspring is sterile. Cannot produce their own kind. What kind of a break is that anyway? It's God's break. It says you can't do it. And God has maintained his creation by rules and laws that he himself has put into it and has made. Now let me go to evolution just for a moment again. I know this is a little disorderly. I have to tell you what I do. I look at the faces of the people and see if it's getting across. And I am tremendously encouraged. I would have to tell you that I didn't expect there to be such an interest, and I did not expect the response to be as it has been. So maybe there's a greater need than I understand there to be for this kind of thing. So we approach creation with a presupposition. See, that's what we get charged with, so we're saying guilty. The evolutionist, the person who is a rationalist and will not accept revelation, and rationalism and revelation seem to be totally opposed in this realm. So they say, these Christians who believe the Bible, they come to the whole question with a presupposition. Yes, guilty. We come with a presupposition. And what is our presupposition? God. That's our presupposition. But wait a minute. The evolutionist who is supposed to be so objective, he comes to a problem without any determination as to what he will find. He is absolutely open in his mind. He's ready for any results. He's ready to find out whatever there is truth in. He's open to it. Wait, he has a presupposition too. You know what his presupposition is? No God. Can you make a difference in the degree of presupposition? I can't. We say God is. And they say God is not. So when God is not, when they dismiss God from his own creation, it's no wonder they come up with fantastic arguments. Now, the argument for evolution runs like this, and I am not giving you my own words now. I am giving you the words of Professor William T. Keaton, and William T. Keaton's textbooks are used in most biology courses in colleges and universities today. Almost every school of natural science in the world uses the textbooks of Dr. William T. Keaton. And I want to tell you what Dr. William T. Keaton says. Number one, this is his explanation of evolution. He says present life forms were not created. Present life forms were not created. The second premise is they have evolved from simpler life forms over vast ages. Number three, and this is the reason I'm reading Dr. Keaton word for word. I'm in Canada. The process by which this happened was without purpose or design. Do you get that? The process was totally random. No purpose. No design. No plan. So these random developments had no object, had no purpose, had no control. Now, this is the reason we're saying. There are lots of dear people who say they believe the Bible, but they believe that God used the process of evolution to bring about what we have in our world, in our natural world. You know, they are not true evolutionists. Because true evolutionists believe there was no plan, absolutely none. There was no purpose. It was totally random. In other words, it was accidental. A young man stood in my living room one day. He had just graduated from the University of Michigan. And he said, I believe I have a lot more courage than you have, he said to me. That might be true, but he said, you see, I believe that I'm just an absurd mistake. There's no purpose for me being here. I can face that and you can't. You have to make up some purpose. The world doesn't have much to offer, does it? No wonder we have myriads of young people without restraint, without any control over their behavior, who think they're just like animals and can live like animals and die like animals in this godless world in which we live. So, what are the proofs that evolutionists use again? I think you have them. I'm not sure just what's on your... Yes, I think you do have some of these on your outline on the second page. Spontaneous generation. We have dealt with that to the best of our ability and shown that... not be spontaneous generation. It has to be biogenesis. That is, life must come from life. And you're going to say to me, some here are very quick. And they grasp quickly what is being said, so I have to make an explanation. When I say that biogenesis is the story of life, and I say life came from life, and you say where did the first life come from, and I say from the life. Isn't that what we read in John chapter 1 today? In him life was, and the life was the light of man. Yes, I believe in biogenesis. I believe that life can only come from life. And listen, don't think it's stupid to believe that. Everything in nature proves it. Life comes from life and nowhere else. Why do you think these scientists, these geneticists, why do you think these people are working so hard to clone animals? They're hoping that by some accidental thing that they might happen to land on how life can originate. Just from putting chemicals together hasn't happened. And if they could produce what would be the simplest life cell, the simplest molecule that could, even by a stretch of imagination, said to be living, I want to tell you something. It wouldn't have any ability to replicate itself. That's not life.
So life comes from life. And the argument of the evolutionist that it just appeared is a fairy tale. It could not. The radioactive dating, I was asked about this in the interval, so in the lunch time, so let me tell you a little bit, if I can, about radioactive dating. On your outline, I think if you look at your sheet, I believe it says on there that there are three forms, major forms this is, of radioactive dating. There's potassium argon, uranium lead, and carbon 14. Now, some of our dear brethren will tell me that there's evidence for an ancient life on Earth going back millions of years from these radioactive dating systems. You won't mind if I tell you I don't believe it, will you? But then you're going to say, well, prove it. All right? Actually, radiometric dating is what it's usually called, is the measurement of the disintegration of radioactive elements. In other words, in volcanic rock. That's the simplest way to explain it. Volcanic rock contains radioactive elements. It is possible to measure the rate at which that radioactive material is decaying. And of course, oftentimes it leaves an end product which can also be measured. So what you're saying is that if bones are lying upon a certain rock stratum, that you measure the radioactivity of the rock and say, this rock has deteriorated, its radioactivity has been bled off, has been used up, and therefore this rock is 4.3 million years old. Do they do that? Not really. Not really. Doesn't work like that. I live in Jackson, Michigan. We have a museum in our town, and the reason we have it there is that two of the astronauts who went to the moon came from Jackson. So we have a museum, and it has moon rocks. Somebody asked me the other day what they look like, and I told them they look just about like those Cambrian rocks that you see all over the surface of Newfoundland. Look just about like that. And so on those displays, on those exhibits, it'll say under one rock it's 4.3 billion years old. Another one will say 4.6 billion years old. Why, they're very careful, aren't they? They know exactly how old they are. So how do you think they date those rocks? How do you think they do? Remember the boy with the ruler? They believe that those rocks have a certain appearance. Did you think they dated them radioactively? Oh, come on. Radiometric dating is only good for a few thousand years. They date those rocks by saying, this is the kind of rock that is in the Cambrian layer of Earth. And the Cambrian layer of Earth is 4.6 billion years ago, and therefore this rock is 4.6 billion years old. That's how they date it. So once again, they have used the time scale which they themselves have set up. And remember again, that time scale is set up because evolution needs such a long, long, long time. I know there are people here that haven't got the greatest interest in all this technical material, but let me give you a simple illustration. Supposing you took the parts of a Swiss watch movement, and every single part, every little item that goes up into make, I'm not talking now about a quartz watch, I'm talking about the original movements of Swiss watches. And you took every single part and you put it in a paper bag. Every tiny little part is in there, every little wheel, every spring, everything that makes it up. And you shake it for 10 minutes and you look inside the bag. Didn't make a watch. No. How about if you shake it for an hour? No, hasn't made a watch. Well, shake it until your arm's tired. It hasn't made a watch. shake it for a million years. What couldn't be done in a day maybe can be done in a million years. If that's logical reasoning, no. All you'd have done in a million years is to wear out every part and it would never fit together. Never. That's the theory of the great ages that are needed. Because what couldn't happen in a short period of time, maybe it happened in a very, very long period of time. Maybe. And therefore the great lengths of time are needed. That's a major argument that we have regarding this whole thing. Now go back to the radiometric dating just for a minute. Because the men who use radiometric dating all the time, because they've been challenged, there have been some rather alarming results that have come out of those challenges. They have been given, for instance, volcanic rock that came out of a 19th century volcanic eruption, and they dated that rock at 160 million years. It wasn't rock 100 years ago. So it didn't start its radioactive decay until it became a rock. Strange, isn't it? In fact, that particular method of potassium argon was used to date Lucy. And Lucy, as you all know, is 2,300,000 years old. They used radiometric dating to prove it. Potassium argon. But the same people have been given live mollusks from the sea, and the creature was still inside. And the radioactive dating has said that they were 2,300 years old. A snail had almost the same result, only a lot higher. It was 26,000 years old. Mortar from an English castle was dated at being almost 8,000 years old. Fresh seal skins were dated at 1,300 years old. They were fresh. What changes all that? Why are those results so inaccurate? Because they have a premise that the release of the radioactive material is steady over all the ages. Even though they know that volcanic action, even industrial burning, solar flares, even sunspots change all of those rates. So once again, it's a desire to have evidence for these tremendous periods of time. Because without those periods of time, evolution is not. It doesn't exist. The argument of the evolutionists, as I've tried to show, is from natural progression, and I've already gone into that in great detail. And now let me go to another subject which will help some here today. When I was talking about adaptation, when I said that a bird's feathers change color to suit its environment, and this happens throughout all of nature, that is, if you want to call it that, I won't object. It is microevolution. Micro. Very small changes. Not changes in physical characteristics any more than perhaps color or size. You see a Labrador retriever is bigger than a French poodle. Size, big difference. Okay, that's adaptation. But there is not a shred of evidence to prove that microevolution ever became macroevolution. The change from species to species. That's what we're saying. The geologic column. This is a whole new subject we're launching into now. This is my own little field. If I know anything about these subjects, I know a little bit about this subject. Because I took geology completely. Not that I know much about it, but okay. The geologic column actually tells us that there is a progression from the very oldest rock to the very youngest rock. We actually today are in the Quaternary period of geology, and this is where you have man and all the most recent developments in nature. But you go back to the Precambrian rock, which only had the most primitive life forms, and that goes back about 3 billion years ago in the measurements of the geologist. And of course, following Precambrian rock was Cambrian rock, which had the first evidence of the invertebrates. Also, Ordovician stratum tells us that there were invertebrates in it too. And then in the Silurian geologic age, you have fish. In the Devonian, you have amphibians. In the Mississippian, you have reptiles. And also in the Pennsylvanian and in the Permian. And in the Triassic, every boy and girl here knows what you have. You have dinosaurs. And what was the movie? Jurassic Park. That comes from the Jurassic period in geology. So the Cretaceous period, of course, you also had dinosaurs. And then what we have as a most recent geologic age has actually five epochs in it, and it goes from 70 million years ago to 12 million years ago, and then finally the age in which we are now, which dates back to 2 to 3 million years ago. All right, what a wonderful story. All the way from the most primitive invertebrates and the most primitive life forms up to man. It's all there, isn't it? You could take a drill that can drill a core, and you could drill down through the surface of the earth. And when you brought up the core, if you could drill deeply enough, you would have all these ages. There they are right there. There's the geologic column from Precambrian to our present Quaternary. There it is. Pleistocene is the latest epoch in this Quaternary period. So it's all there. It's not there. It's not anywhere. That's amazing. It isn't there. I could take you to vast areas of the United States where Precambrian rock, not just a mountain, but literally hundreds of square miles where Precambrian rock is on the surface. And underneath that Precambrian rock is a layer of fine silt that looks like it's never been disturbed. How does the geologist explain that? They don't. The geologic column is a fact. They have proven it. And any evidence to the contrary is just ignored. That's the way the story goes. I detect behind all this a tremendous deception of the devil. So boys and girls are going to say to me, well, Mr. Crawford, you mentioned there about this Mississippian and this Pennsylvanian and this Permian period in which there were dinosaurs. So were there dinosaurs? Certainly there were dinosaurs. Certainly there were. And some of them, as you probably know, of tremendous size. I think you boys and girls know that Brontosaurus could measure as long as 80 feet and be 17 feet high. And the Tyrannosaurus, that dreadful creature of so voracious with its great rows of teeth, did they exist? Yes, they existed. Yes, they did. Do they have any ancestors in the world today? I mean, do they have any progeny? Are these the ancestors of creatures living today? I don't know. Most biologists say not. Most of them say we do not have any creatures today. Any of our lizards today in the world are really offspring of those great creatures. That may well be. So when did they live? They lived before the flood. In fact, in the days before the flood, and this is a great huge subject, in the days before the flood, there was an even climate over the whole planet. Is that just a fairy tale? No, that's true. You know those great mammoths that have been found in the Siberian tundra? You know, they were frozen in the ice. Do you know they were frozen so suddenly that the food is still in their stomach? Do you know that expeditions to northern Siberia have dug up those creatures and broiled them on a barbecue? The meat is still fresh. I don't know how dry it would be. I'm afraid it would be quite dry. But how did those creatures get suddenly... I mean, they're in silt, frozen, solid in a mass. And their bodies undecayed. And they were in perfect health. And they're frozen just like... How did that happen? A catastrophe. A great catastrophe. And they're frozen suddenly. What's more, the vegetation in their stomachs is subtropical. So... They weren't eating the tundra of the Arctic. They have obviously had good food. Why? Because we believe that there was a canopy effect. You see, before the flood, the rain didn't come down from the sky. Water came up from the earth and watered the earth. And because of the conditions, because of the climatic conditions of that time, plants and animals grew to a tremendous size. I have seen fossils of ferns, of bushes that are only little bushes in our world, and they are gigantic. They are tremendous in their size. Do you know why? There was nothing to kill them. There was no frost. And perhaps even not as many pests as we have in our modern world. So they developed to great sizes. So did the animals. So did these reptiles. Developed into great sizes. And lived likely for long periods of time. But they were wiped out. Were they wiped out before the flood? I would think so. I can't be dogmatic. It may be that Noah actually took into the ark some of that species. I don't know. He wouldn't have had to take in a brontosaurus, but there might have been other creatures. They're actually forms of one species. Therefore, he could have taken them into the ark. But I don't know that. And according to biologists today, we do not have any offspring from those great monsters of that past time. The fossil remains of man are much more interesting to us. And haven't they found evidence of ancient man in the fossils? Like I mentioned, Lucy, Dr. Richard Leakey, who discovered Lucy, he told us without a shadow of a doubt, he found Lucy in Kenya, Africa. And he told us without blushing, that she was 2,300,000 years old. Wonderful deduction. Doesn't know that. In fact, the story of human fossil remains is a shame to anthropologists and to paleontologists. All of us know the story of Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was actually found by Charles Dawson in England in 1911. And for 40 years, it was displayed in the Royal Museum of Natural History in London as a genuine ancestor of modern man. And you know the story of the Piltdown Man, don't you? It was the skull of a modern human, and it was the jawbone of an ape. And it was a fraud. It was put together to deceive. In fact, there's evidence now, and I've seen some very critical reviews of this thing. And it was actually found that the bones were colored to change their appearance. So that was just a fraud. Well, you say, what about the Cro-Magnon man? What about all the Neanderthal man that has been found, and the Pithecanthropus fossils and all this sort of thing? You know, it can be explained in a very simple way. In fact, we have seen evidence in this sort of thing that some of those fossils were ordinary people that had arthritis. Could you believe that? They weren't normal. They were diseased people, like some of us. And their fossils are supposed to be different from ours. And when they tell you about Neanderthal man, they keep telling you that he lived as much as 35,000 years ago, but he has exactly the same skull, exactly the same facial bones, exactly the same skeletal structure. So how do they know he's so old? Well, because he was a Stone Age man. He didn't have modern tools. So all the Stone Age men are dead, are they? Well, don't go to Borneo, because there's still Stone Age men in Borneo. In fact, talking about extinct creatures, did you see that picture in the National Geographic magazine of the dinosaur that a Japanese trawler pulled up from the ocean? It's only been dead a few weeks. It wasn't really an extinct species after all. And the photograph was so clear. A photograph of a dinosaur. True. A mammal who actually lived in the sea and was living up till 1996. Quite different than an extinct species. There have been many other cases like that.